the internet and welcome to this special bonus episode of the Cracked Podcast. Yes, bonus episode. We would normally be dark this week, but we're co-producing this episode with GE as part of their Breakthrough series on the National Geographic Channel. Basically, GE and Nat Geo, we're on a nickname basis now, teamed up with Ron Howard, Ronnie H., and Brian Grazer. No nickname for him. I just call him Bri Bri. You know Ron Howard. He's the director of a bunch of really successful movies, Beautiful Mind and Heart of the Sea coming up, which the preview for that, as a fan of Jaws, that got me super pumped up. Brian Grazer is kind of his producing partner and also the producer of tons of great stuff. Anyways, they're all teaming up to make a TV series called Breakthrough, where each episode is directed by a different filmmaker. The first one, the one we're talking about today, is directed by Peter Berg, the director of Friday Night Lights and a bunch of other really cool movies. They also just have really interesting pairing of filmmaker talent and subject. Like, they talk to David Cronenberg, the famous body horror movie director of movies like Crash and The Fly and A History of Violence, about the subject of the future enmeshing of technology and the human body and mech suits and transhumanism and basically why we're all going to be cyborgs in the future. All the cutting edge ways they're turning our species into cyborgs. Anyways, as part of that series, they offered us, me, the Cracked Podcast, access to some of the scientific brain power that they were interviewing in the series. For instance, I've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about their neuroscientist David Eagleman, who is the author of the book Incognito, which is one of my favorite nonfiction books of the past 5 years. It's about how the human mind doesn't work the way you think and I thought before I read his book. Anyways, David Eagleman's doing some of the most interesting research into the human mind that anyone is doing on the planet. And they let me speak with someone who works in his lab for one of these episodes, which I don't know what they were thinking, letting me talk to a real important scientist. Like, aren't they scared that I'm going to ask a bunch of dumb questions about science fiction movies? But apparently they weren't, because they let me talk about the Terminator franchise and the movie WALL-E to a guy who builds actual mech suits for a living. And they let me talk to David Eagleman's graduate assistant about using the technology he's working with to create a hypothetical supervillain who has a sense of police location, the way you and I have a sense of smell, and has a mind-controlled drone he uses as a third arm. But that's the basic idea. If you're interested in conversations about how technology is going to make the future look like a sci-fi movie, we'll be dropping an extra episode of the Cracked Podcast every week for the next 4 weeks on that subject. I'll be talking to some real live scientists about how their fields are going to make the future look like sci-fi movies, asking them the questions about sci-fi movies that other people are too proud or well-informed or afraid of looking like an idiot to ask scientists. Anyways, up first, Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, and I are talking to a gentleman by the name of Dr. David Barish, who is an emergency physician and an expert in emergency medicine. Those guys who are racing around in hazmat suits in movies like Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak and Kate Winslet in Contagion. David Barish is a specialist on running into hospitals and shouting, "Contain the room! I need a containment unit at the west and east entrances of the hospital, and I need them now." Dr. Barish and his field in general are coming off of one of the biggest, most intense natural experiments in their area of expertise with the horrifying Ebola outbreak last year around this time. And what you learn in the series and just reading up on the journalism from the front lines of the Ebola outbreak is that actual apocalyptic outbreaks aren't like the ones in movies like Outbreak and Contagion, where the camera follows the well-informed people in hazmat suits around as they practice science in hermetically sealed containment units and quarantined hospitals. They're more like the outbreaks in I Am Legend and World War Z and horror movies that make room for the chaos and mobs of people rioting. And outbreak movies are their own kind of mini genre that travels around in the helicopters with the science detectives. The movie touchstone I actually kept coming back to, weirdly, is the final scene in E.T., where the government agents in hazmat suits invade the quiet suburban town, because that's the closest movies come to putting you in the position that you'd most likely be in, not in the science copter with outbreak Sherlock Holmes, but down on the ground, not knowing why a battalion of people in spacesuits just descended on your town and started taking your neighbors and your family members away. So that's what we talked to Dr. David Barish about. It's really interesting conversation if you're interested in this sort of thing. Anyways, hope you enjoy the conversation. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Okay, I'm joined on the phone by David Barish. David, do you want to tell our listeners what you do for a living?
Well, by background, I'm an emergency physician. I've been practicing emergency medicine for about 30 years. In the last 5 years of my career, I've been with General Electric. First 2.5 years, I was with GE Healthcare in one of their divisions. In the last 2.5 years, I've had the opportunity to work with the GE Foundation, leading the healthcare portfolio globally, which also includes our disaster and humanitarian response portfolio.
And on the other line, we have joining us from Nashville, a New York Times bestselling author of John Dies at the End, and this book is full of spiders. Seriously, dude, don't touch it. Jason Pargin, who writes as David Wong. Sorry, Jason, if I made you sound silly by coming in, saying the title of your book after David's impressive resume.
It's fine. The listener needs to know who the expert is here. And it isn't me, so that sets it up perfectly.
Sure. Jason had a question for you up top just about your area of expertise and sort of how it's depicted in movies.
Yeah, and in my opinion, a lot of the panic over the recent Ebola outbreak that we had here in America was because people's kind of education on pandemics comes from movies. So like the last one I saw was a movie called Contagion. And the timeline in that film, they said by day 8 had infected 250,000 people worldwide. And by day 18, it was in the millions. And after 1 month, all of society had broken down. And the scenario in that movie is similar to what you see in a lot of outbreak movies, where someone is overseas and gets infected. They get on a plane and come back to America and wind up infecting everybody at the airport terminal, you know, everybody at the hospital. Is that timeline where something spreads around the globe, you know, within weeks, is that at all realistic? And if it's not, like, what's preventing that?
Well, it's a good question. I think there is a lot of fear when these pandemics occur. Some of it's justified and some of it, I think, is not justified. One of the things that you saw with Ebola is that in countries where there was a system in place, whether it was the United States or Nigeria or other countries where there was a healthcare system, there wasn't the spread of Ebola that you saw in the three most affected countries. In Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, the healthcare system was really not positioned and not equipped to be able to deal with an outbreak like Ebola. But when it went into Nigeria, they were prepared. They had seen other communicable diseases. Polio was one that they were in the process of trying to eradicate. In the U.S., obviously, we have a healthcare system, including organizations like the CDC, that can help us respond to transmission of diseases like Ebola. So it's possible that something like that could happen, but it's highly unlikely given the systems that we have in place, at least in developed parts of the world. In developing countries, like the three affected countries we saw in West Africa, the spread may not be unrealistic. And we had numbers projecting 1.4 million deaths by January, February 2015. So the projections were pretty scary. We were able to stem the tide, fortunately, because we were able to get the response in place and some of the systems in place that we needed to bring that back down.
When you're thinking of sort of a nightmare virus or a nightmare illness that could lead to global pandemic, like one of the things that was mentioned about Ebola was the fact that it takes 10 days for the blood test to come back to tell if it was positive or negative at first. And that was just an interesting sort of detail of the disease that I didn't know. I guess I'm wondering, are there conceivable aspects of a disease, like that people don't start showing symptoms for a few days or something like that, that could create the sort of nightmare scenario Jason was describing?
You know, first of all, there are three elements to be able to contain these pandemics or communicable diseases. The first one is to be able to prevent, and we can go back to that in a minute, because at the very outset, what you really want to do is prevent the infection from occurring or prevent the outbreak from occurring. The second thing you want to be able to do is detect not just that there's an outbreak or pandemic, but each individual case as quickly as you can. And the third element is you want to be able to treat each case and treat the population as quickly as you can. So from the detection perspective, if you don't have a test or a set of symptoms that allow you to detect the disease early, you obviously run the risk that people will be contagious before there's any sign that they actually have this deadly virus, if you will.
When we talk about the steps to try to contain it, like obviously, you know, a test is important, and then being able to, I assume, keep people who are infectious from spreading. It seemed like that was a big part of the controversy when the Ebola thing happened, because I know there was the famous case of the nurse who had come back, the Ebola nurse who had come back to, I think, Maine, and she was not showing symptoms, but the governor had, like, ordered her not to leave her home. I think that was the first time in my life I saw it play out, sort of the ethical debate about quarantine. Like, to what right do we have to tell this person you're not allowed, you know, like to take away their freedom based on, you know, trying to contain an outbreak? But I would think in, you know, developing countries, that has to be even harder, doesn't it? Like trying to contain and keep people from going from place to place. Or was it even harder in America, where we're so resistant to being told, you know, no, you're not allowed to, you know, until we've got all of the tests, you're not allowed to go anywhere?
Sure. You know, I think there's two elements to containment that need to be considered. The first one is really the facts. And what are the facts behind making a decision to quarantine or contain potential carriers of a virus? The second issue is really the trust issues or the political issues behind containment decisions. If you think about the facts portion of it first, you know, in the case of the nurse, it appeared, at least from what we were hearing, that she probably did not need to be quarantined in the way she was being quarantined. However, there was this tremendous fear, maybe irrational fear, that people thought had she been anywhere in an affected country, she needed to be quarantined. I heard numerous stories of people who traveled to East Africa who, when coming back to the United States, were asked if they should be quarantined. East Africa is about as far from the affected Ebola countries as New York is from Los Angeles. So the rationality behind that was absent. So there's the facts piece, and then there's, can we trust the decisions that are being made, and who's making those decisions, and what are they making those decisions based upon? Is it based upon fear? Is it based upon what they're hearing in the media? Is it based upon political pressure? And so there are elements that play into that that aren't always completely rational or fair to the potential victims of containment or sequestration.
Yeah, there was a neighborhood where they were rioting in Liberia because they were, I think, trying to put a border around the entire neighborhood. And there's a great moment in the documentary where you see this SUV races in and people get out in what looks like spacesuits. It's almost somewhat similar to the effect at the end of E.T. when these guys in spacesuits get out in this suburban neighborhood. There were scenes from the Ebola outbreak that made it clear that containment can be a really messy thing, and sometimes messier than even what we see in those movies like Outbreak and Contagion, where a lot of the battle is being waged in sealed off rooms.
You know, you'll see in the film where Dr. Black comments upon what I think is a very personal and emotional part of the Ebola outbreak, where she describes the idea that here you are as a mother with a sick child, handing your sick child over to somebody in a spacesuit and recognizing or feeling or fearing that you'll never see your child again. You'll never be able to touch your child again. There's a tremendous amount of trust that has to occur for a parent, a mother, a sibling, or anybody to turn that child over to a person in a spacesuit who is, for all intents and purposes, faceless. How does one do that? And then you imagine that that's being done to an entire community. that's extraordinarily difficult for that community to experience. It's extraordinarily difficult for that parent to experience. So there has to be trust, there has to be a belief that the, quote, authorities know what they're doing and have your best interests, your child's best interests in mind, and that it will turn out okay because you trust them. That's very, very difficult in a scenario like that.
How do they get over that fear with people? That almost seems impossible. I'm not trying to be glib, but it almost would be the equivalent of like aliens coming here and telling me, oh, you've got this disease. We need to take your family away. But trust me, we're more advanced. You know, we know how to fix it. I know there's got to be like a huge amount of resistance there.
I think that's what you were saying. I think there was a tremendous amount of resistance. I think the fear was just what I described, but the fear was also people were staying at home and didn't want to go to the healthcare facilities because if you went to a healthcare facility, you would get sick because that's where Ebola was. That was their belief. And so being able to message, to teach, to engender the trust of the people that you had the ability to take care of them, you had their best interests in mind, is a very, very difficult challenge.
I can't imagine that that would be any easier to quarantine a lower class neighborhood in America, you know, no matter what city you went to. The advancements and sort of the fact that we're a medically and scientifically advanced country doesn't really matter when there are people who don't trust authority for very good reason.
And these are countries that are not too far out of conflict, out of major conflicts. So even though they may be 10 plus years out of these conflicts, it wasn't that long ago. And you can imagine that how much more difficult it is to trust not just your government, your neighbors, the system. It's a very difficult challenge.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, the Ebola outbreak happened in West Africa. In most of these movies, the outbreak, it's very similar. I think in the movie Outbreak, the Dustin Hoffman one, I think it was Zaire. Somebody was bitten by a monkey, and then they traveled to the United States. If there were some sort of new pandemic to come along, is that where it would come from? Is there some reason why we think of Africa as being our breeding ground for diseases that we don't yet have cures for?
Well, I don't know if it's based on fact necessarily. I think it's based on maybe other factors. I think, you know, what brings about fear is the unknown. And I think one of the things that happened with Ebola is it was such an unknown disease in the rapidity with which it was spreading and how broadly it was spreading. We saw the transmission rate being incredibly high. We saw the mortality rate being incredibly high. And it's a gruesome death. And when you put those factors together, it becomes like the Contagion movie. But if you think about the facts, how many people died from Ebola? You know, tens of thousands, 20-some-odd thousand people died from this most recent Ebola outbreak. Two times that many or more die from influenza in the United States every year. The other pandemics that occur, 25 million people from AIDS. The numbers are just extraordinary if you think about some of the other pandemics that we are experiencing and have experienced in the past. There's something about the unknown, something about it maybe from animal to human transmission, something about it being new that creates this extraordinary fear that gets the media's attention, gets our attention, and gets us to really react in ways that you wouldn't expect. And quite frankly, we should be reacting, I wouldn't say in the same way, but we should be reacting very strongly to H1N1, to MERS, to other pandemics that could be coming along and could kill many, many, many more people than Ebola ever did.
I think that latter part, like the gruesome, fantastical element of Ebola, like the crazy way that it kills, I think the media can't stay away from the sensational aspect of it. Like one thing that bothers me a little bit about the coverage of these things is that we were never upset about an outbreak in Africa because we were concerned about Africans. America was concerned about the outbreak because it was a really crazy, flamboyant disease, and B, it's like, oh my God, it's going to come over here. There's almost a catch-22 where you want people to be concerned about this issue because there's obviously people that need help over there, but it's hard to get people to care about it unless they feel like there's the threat of it showing up here. When, as you mentioned, we in the developed world were fortunate enough that, you know, we have all sorts of infrastructure to contain these things, but it's almost like we have to tell ourselves a very exotic story of, well, oh my gosh, what if we all get Ebola? And as you mentioned, people coming from any part of that continent being treated with suspicion. Like, well, you could have Ebola and you might not know. But it's not any concern for that person's health. It's only concern of, well, gosh, what if Africa gets some of its disease on us?
So there's sort of the yin and the yang of the media attention. You know, you have to be grateful for the attention that the media gave to Ebola, because I think had they not, it would have been like a boiling frog scenario where we would have had Ebola continuing to occur in West Africa. Nobody would have paid attention, and then it would have really taken root and maybe killed a million people before we even knew it. The fact of the matter is that two Americans caught Ebola. We heard about it. It got a tremendous amount of attention, Kent Brantley and the nurse from Samaritan's Purse, who got sick. And as soon as they got sick, we started paying attention. And fortunately, that happened, so we were able to bring the resources together to begin to fight Ebola and stem it. Had that not happened, had Kent Brantley not gotten Ebola, we might have had a scenario where we may have had several hundred thousand deaths in West Africa before the developing world started to pay attention. And that's sad. We need the media to bring attention to it, but we also need the media to bring attention to it in a rational way so that the irrational fears that we've been talking about don't occur.
You mentioned different diseases that have done way more damage in the past. Are there other kind of plagues or examples of disease that frighten you as somebody who's an expert in these things and feel like they could happen again that we don't know about?
Well, there absolutely are diseases in the environment that we don't know about. There's no question in my mind that there will be new diseases that will be discovered, in part because people will get sick from them and in part because we'll get technology to be able to identify what they are. What would scare me would be a disease outbreak where we don't have what I talked about before, the ability to detect it, or if we could detect it, to treat it, and a deadly, very deadly virus or other organism that could kill without detection and was highly contagious. Sure, that would be scary. The reassuring thing, though, is that we do have health systems in place. We've got advancing technology, great scientists who are able to detect these viruses and communicable diseases as they start to occur. And if we don't know about them, we've got the technology to pretty rapidly figure out what's going on to be able to then be able to detect them. So is there a doomsday scenario that could occur? Sure. Is there a likelihood that that's going to happen? I don't think so. You know, one of the things that has to happen is the global community needs to care that if there's an outbreak in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia or India or Latin America, that it matters to the whole world. You can't turn a blind eye if it's not happening in your backyard. And as we talked about, that's one of the issues with Ebola, is there was this boiling frog scenario until it came to our neighborhood. And then we started to worry about it. And obviously, public health officials think about this every day, but I think the general public needs to start thinking about the importance of paying attention to what's happening in areas that may not be so visible to them on a daily basis. We do live in a globalized world. We do live on planes a lot of our time on each day. And so communicable diseases are going to move around the world, and we need to start thinking globally about this. And if it's happening in West Africa, we need to start worrying about it and making sure that we take care of those people in West Africa, because as we saw, it wasn't just those people in West Africa that we suddenly became concerned about. It became a global issue. We should have been thinking about that 18 months earlier, and probably tens of thousands of lives could have been saved.
It seems like part of the unspoken premise of all these movies, or, you know, pandemics as they exist in popular culture, is that mankind is so much more mobile now than we were in the past. That, you know, the theory seems to be that, yeah, in the past they didn't understand germ theory or anything else, and so that's why you saw, you know, the Black Plague and all that. But that those diseases were also constrained to land masses, where today, you know, as I mentioned, most of these movies open up with a traveler getting sick and then getting on a plane. So that's where the idea seems to be, that if something new and exotic should come up, the whole issue would be is that somebody could get it, and it's somebody on a business trip where they go from Africa, fly into U.S. the next week before they're too sick to travel, they go to Beijing, and suddenly, you know, they could have the contagion on five continents before anybody even realizes what's happening. But it sounds like in most countries we're not unaware of something like that occurring. Like, they have a system in place, but it seems like that's the nightmare scenario, that something new would come along, and because of how freely we travel across borders, that maybe there would be this desperate race to catch up with it. But is that not as much of a threat as what people seem to think?
No, I think it makes it more of a global threat. So if you think about some of the epidemics that occurred previously, you mentioned plague. Those were local threats, but killed very rapidly because the systems weren't in place. So they killed millions of people because the systems weren't in place. So they just didn't have a healthcare system at those times to be able to address it. Now the healthcare systems are in place, so the threat is really that it's going to move from place to place before it's going to be able to be contained. So as opposed to being a local phenomenon where many people are wiped out, it becomes a global phenomenon where, in theory, many more people will be wiped out. And we counterbalance that with the idea that we have systems in place to try to contain this. And I do think, as I mentioned earlier, I do think there's an element of the fear of the unknown or exotic. If it comes from Southeast Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, in the Western world, there's a feeling that that's exotic. And so it's much more feared than influenza that happens to your next door neighbor or to one of your family members. That's much more understandable and feels less exotic. So it's not as feared as something that might come from Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, or elsewhere. There are a lot of people who refuse to get their influenza vaccines here in the United States for reasons that are unknown, and yet influenza is more likely to kill them than some of these diseases that bring about tremendous fear.
Yeah, it's almost like the technology of containment and treatment is in a race with the technology of transportation and, you know, all the different ways that we can spread people, hosts around extremely quickly.
And a race against mutations, because these things mutate very quickly. And so, you know, as much as we think we're going to contain the current virus, they're going to mutate and give us a different virus in 12 to 18 months.
One quick thing, just kind of a sidebar. The thing that made me start getting a flu shot every year was my wife's a doctor, and she explained to me the idea that you're not getting it for you so you don't get sick, but we can still carry the disease and give it to elderly people or babies or, you know, people who it can drastically affect. If that was part of the PR campaign, the idea that it's a selfless thing to do, I always hear people saying, yeah, I'll take my chances with the flu this year or something like that. But if you knew that, but it could kill your grandfather when you see him, I feel like that would possibly be more successful.
Ultimately, you need the populace to be smart about how they're behaving. And by and large, because viruses are invisible, because these contagions are invisible, we tend to think if I'm not sick right now, then I'm fine. You know, and we don't wash our hands regularly. Like, there are so many things that we would do different if we could see viruses. Everything about our behavior, if we could see them flying out of our mouth when we talk to people. And so I remember the PSAs that were going around about teaching people how to cough properly. You know, coughing into your sleeve instead of coughing into your hand. There's a lot of little habits, it seems like, that we at the ground level do wrong that have to make the job of containment 10 times harder, because the average person, you don't think of yourself as a carrier.
I think that's true, and I'm not sure what makes people respond to saying, I will get the flu vaccine this year. I think you may be right that it's, you know, I don't want my child to get sick. I don't want my, you know, my grandmother to get sick. And many people may say, it's just all about me. I don't know how people respond to that choice. I would love for people to respond and say, it's the right thing to do for our population that we all get vaccinated so we can stem the tide of spread for everybody. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily the way people respond. I think they'll respond to either me or my child or my grandfather or my sister or somebody else like that.
But I think we were successful with HIV to an extent. You know, I grew up in the 80s, and the first education about AIDS and HIV was really being driven home, you know, in when I was in high school and getting into college. And it seems like, in terms of, you know, this was a disease where it was all about changing people's behavior, you know, using condoms, things like that. It seemed like that was very successful because, again, it was about teaching people, giving them a very specific idea of what causes this to spread and what doesn't. And when you had something where you could have it and then, you know, it could be years before you showed symptoms, obviously it was crucial to change how people act in their day-to-day life. It seems like that's difficult, but it's not impossible. It just takes a huge amount of education. And that's got to be even harder in countries where, you know, maybe the mass media isn't as developed or whatever.
Well, I think HIV/AIDS is a really good example also of how things can go wrong. And what Dr. Barish was talking about earlier, the idea of getting people to care about people that they don't necessarily, you know, associate with their friends or family members, or it was seen as a gay disease throughout the 80s. And a lot of people died because it wasn't, you know, necessarily treated as a mainstream disease for a long time until Magic Johnson had his press conference and retired.
One thing that comes up, and to go fall back to films on the subject again, is that very quickly in the process of an outbreak, and this is true in zombie movies too, which I realize is not the same thing, but that's another way that Hollywood tells that story of an infection spreading. But one thing that happens is that the institutions break down very quickly. The government stops showing up, you know, the military stops showing up. Like, you know, and I know that for the film's sake, that's just to up the drama. But in the countries where these outbreaks occur, does that tend to happen? Do things, do like local governments or whatever, do they hold up in the face of the panic and everything that's going on?
Well, I think the evidence from Ebola is no, they don't hold up. I think when there's fear like that, especially when you see the transmission to healthcare workers. Healthcare workers started not showing up to work in the three affected countries because going to work put you and your family at a tremendous risk given the transmission rate, given the highly effective rate and the mortality rate. And that's not just in the healthcare system. I think other people, in an effort to protect their families and to protect themselves and the fear of what was going to happen, would stop showing up at work. And what happens is productivity goes down, security becomes an issue. There's concerns about health in the environment, and the economy starts to really have difficulty. And I think you saw tremendous economic consequences in West Africa, which had a ripple effect outside West Africa. There were economic consequences for countries that traded with West Africa or where transportation had to occur there. There were a number of mining companies in West Africa where they essentially had to shut down their operations and were losing millions and millions of dollars per month as a result of the Ebola outbreak.
So if you had to kind of summarize how the battle with Ebola was won, how Ebola was eventually contained, what would you kind of point to as the key factors, the things that we did right?
So I would say there were a couple of things that happened. And again, having not been firsthand, involved in taking care of patients, I'll give you my observations on it. Number one is I think we did get the resources together to start to really pay attention to this. And so as difficult as it was to accept that it took an American to be infected for us to pay attention, thank goodness an American did get infected so we could pay attention. And we have paid attention in a big way, not just Americans, but Europeans. And globally, we started to look at what we needed to do to contain the virus. The second thing is you had multiple sectors involved in trying to address this. You had governmental sector, the local governments, as well as international organizations trying to help. You had civil society, non-governmental organizations engaged in trying to help and risking their lives, literally risking their lives to go in to try to take care of patients and detect the disease. And then you had the private sector who began to pay attention, in large part because of the economic consequences, but finally did pay attention to what was happening and really came together in a way that we haven't really seen as effectively previously. But the private sector came together and partnered with the other societal entities to try to make sure that this was contained. So eventually the resources came together. You started to see systems put in place for detection of the disease and treatment of the disease.
Sorry to interrupt you, but when you say the private sector came together, is that kind of major corporations who, like you mentioned, have mining operations shutting down, and so economics essentially works to make it in their best interest, kind of incentivize them to spend money to solve the problem, and that helped fund some of the containment?
They had people who were infected, and they had to shut their operations down because of people who were infected. So their primary effort was to make sure that their people were taken care of. At the same time, some of these mining companies reached out to say, we need support from the rest of the private sector to begin to address some of the issues that are here. As examples, there were obviously many private sector entities that donated money. We donated $2 million to organizations in Sierra Leone and Liberia for their operations to try to combat Ebola. UPS donated their services to be able to transport equipment. Becton Dickinson and many others donated their equipment that would be useful in the fight against Ebola. So in large part, this was all because of people who were infected, who worked in the region for the private sector who were being infected. And then there were, of course, the economic consequences of we need to do something to stem this tide, because there will be economic consequences for the countries and for the people who are combating this. So the private sector engagement was essential because it garnished a lot of resources, not just financially, but expertise, transportation resources, equipment that we and others donated into the region to be able to support the fight against the outbreak.
Something we've noticed when you're debunking myths, a lot of people's kind of preconceptions of parts of the world that they're not familiar with come from movies, which is why we keep bringing you back to Outbreak and Contagion. But in those movies, and I think just in movies in general, corporations are evil. So it's just interesting that there's like sort of this dream team of like corporations coming together where like UPS is like, all right, we're good at getting things around the world, so we'll give you this number of planes. And that's just a cool thing that makes me feel safer that I wouldn't have known about if you hadn't just said that.
You know, like any part of society, corporations aren't perfect. On the other hand, the people who work in corporations and the corporations themselves, they're global citizens. It's important to them that we are part of society and understand our role in society. We play a critical role in society. Yes, you know, part of our mission is to be profitable, but a big part of our mission is to understand our role in society and the opportunity we have to have impact in society and to make the world a better place. And so that's not just GE, but, you know, I mentioned UPS. There are many, many others. Johnson & Johnson has partnered with us and is partnering with us on the global health security agenda. This is really important that we understand our role in society, that we take our role in society very seriously, and we make sure that we bring our resources to the table to do things like fight Ebola, to do things like work with the global health security agenda countries to make sure that they're able to bring the resources together that they need to be effective. Now, I have to say, private sector played a key role in the fight against Ebola and continues to fight an ongoing key role in the global health security agenda, in other pandemics, and I think in the system strengthening part of what we need to do to be able to stem further outbreaks. If we don't, you know, invest in building the systems, the healthcare systems in West Africa, the rest of Sub-Saharan Africa, and other developing countries, we'll see another Ebola, and we'll see it cause tremendous damage, tremendous amount of death. We need to invest in this, and we need to invest in the systems, and private sector plays a big part in that system investment.
I think that there are listeners who are shocked that fighting this took donations, but I think it's the same thing when you hear about, for instance, Bill Gates gave away a significant part of his fortune to fight malaria, buying mosquito nets and things like that. Like, that was one of his personal goals, was to try to wipe out malaria. And I think when I hear about that, A, you think, well, that's nice, but B, it's also, why does it come down to a billionaire to donate? It's like, is that the only thing that was standing between us and this disease that has killed billions? Malaria has killed billions over the centuries. And I guess maybe it's a very naive question, like, why does it come down to donations or companies out of the goodness of their hearts donating services? You would think, does the United Nations not have a fund for this? Like, why, knowing the scale of this problem, why are we depending on people to sort of donate in order to fight it?
I think one of the things to think about is we talk about donor money and talk about philanthropy. From our perspective, we don't think about our philanthropy necessarily as pure philanthropy. We really think about it as an investment in the future and building a world where we can do business and where people are seeing economic prosperity. It's not a chicken or an egg. They come together. And when we invest in West Africa, East Africa, Southeast Asia, with what one would call philanthropic dollars, we're actually doing this because it's the right thing to do for those people. It's the right thing to build their systems, their educational systems, their healthcare systems. But it also improves their economic opportunity. And if you improve their economic opportunities, it also improves the opportunities for everybody who's doing business there, whether it's an educational system, a health system, or a for-profit entity. Everybody rises. And so by us investing, it allows that whole economy to rise, it allows us to do well, and allows the people to do well. And we don't just donate money. We donate our time, we donate equipment, we train people, we build capacity for people who are delivering health care, we train people who have new skills in manufacturing. So there's a lot of things that the private sector does besides just donating money. We actually try to build the systems and the capacity along with that.
Anything else that you want to get to?
No, I think the only thing that I want to make sure gets emphasized is this idea that it's really important to build the systems in order to be able to prevent these outbreaks, to detect them when they occur, and then obviously to treat the patients who need to be treated. I'll give you one example, and this may work for you, is that in Liberia, an organization called Last Mile Health was able to train community health workers to detect the disease very early. And in a couple of counties, they were able actually to reduce the transmission of Ebola to virtually zero. I think in one of the counties they had one case and limited it to that one case. And this was all because they built the system to train community health workers. And by training community health workers, they were able to detect and then contain the disease when it happened. So building the systems to be able to do things like that is critically important. And we have to continue to build these systems even once the Ebola outbreak is contained. We need to continue to focus on building systems so that the next time it happens, we're prepared and we can address it as soon as it happens.
But I think to the average person listening to that, that sounds like this is a problem that other people are solving. There's people in Africa, they're building the systems, they're taking care of it. Is there something you can say, or is there any misconceptions, anything you want to correct for the average person, like how the average person thinks of these diseases, the amount that they spend worrying about them or anything like that? Is there anything you consistently see people be wrong about that if you could just, knowing you're talking to 100,000 or so more people who normally would never read something about this subject, is there anything for them in their everyday life they should be doing or thinking about that helps?
I think what's critical is for people to understand that whether it's Ebola or influenza or non-communicable diseases, these problems are not just somebody else's problem if they happen in West Africa or Southeast Asia or India. These are your problem. It's not as if it's a disease that's being spread in your local community. Now that we live in a world where people do travel by airplane very, very frequently, where people do move around the entire planet very, very easily, a local disease, a local outbreak is really a global outbreak. And we need to start thinking about that everybody needs to contribute to building these systems in sub-Saharan Africa. Everybody needs to contribute to building the systems in Southeast Asia, Latin America, India, and anywhere else in the world, even in the United States and Europe, to make sure that we're all paying attention to this. We don't live in small communities now. We live in one big community where a communicable disease becomes a worldwide issue, and we need to make sure that we understand it's not somebody else's problem. It's all of our problem.
And they contribute to that through charities?
I think the individual person sitting in their living room in the United States can contribute if they have a certain expertise in an area that can be helpful. That would be wonderful. If they want to contribute money, they would contribute to organizations that are building systems in West Africa, and there's innumerable organizations that do this. And I think they contribute by paying attention and listening to the facts and understanding what the facts are and talking about them and getting educated. That's probably the most important thing they could do, is get educated with real facts to understand what's really happening.
And the best source of that education is Jenny McCarthy, right? That's where I get all of my health information from.
Are you kidding?
I am. I am indeed. All right, hope you enjoyed that conversation. Hope you're not too terrified of the future now. Just one footnote. I wrote an article with another gentleman a couple years back that I talk about a lot on the podcast, but in case you haven't read it, it's about the way that the sort of disease-borne apocalypse that we cover in this episode has actually happened in America, the America and American history that you're familiar with that we learned in school is basically just built on top of a actual full-blown disease apocalypse. So you can check that out. Just Google lies you believe about the founding of America. And yeah, hope you enjoyed this. Be sure to check out the series if you did enjoy this. It's called Breakthrough. It's tonight, Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the National Geographic Channel, Nat Geo, my homie. And we will be dropping another bonus ep next week in which we talk about crazy ways science is turning the human species into cyborgs. Talk to you then.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.